The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
Imagine for a moment that you came to Israelite and you had a very specific goal in mind. You wanted to become a righteous person. That's a good goal. And so you came to Israelite and you said, you know, where's Benny Friedman? Hey, this guy may have some way to tell me how to do that, Israelite, whatever. So I said to you, I'll tell you what you need to do if you want to become a righteous person. I want you to find an elephant. I want you to find an elephant. Matter of fact, you know what? I want you to find two elephants. And I want you to put these elephants, okay, into a big hall. The big hall is on King George Street. It's called the Friedler Hall, great synagogue. I want you to bring those two elephants to the hall. Now, to say the least, this would raise your eyebrows. But you want to become a righteous person. You can't imagine for a moment how two elephants in a hall is going to make you a righteous person. But okay, fine. Now imagine that it's not me that's telling you to do this, but God is telling you to do this. Well, then I guess it's a little easier to do, but you do it. And then suppose you finish finding the elephants. And God says, now I want two hippopotamuses. I don't know if you've ever seen a hippopotamus. Once let's try to move a hippopotamus. Not only do your eyebrows raise now, but you begin to wonder how you got yourself into this. And God begins to go down a list. And you try to get two of every animal in the world into this hall. You would imagine that you must be an incredible human being if you not only could do this, but would do this. Now, when you stop to think about it, that's exactly what God comes and tells Noah. I want to take a look at Noah. Noah. And I want to find out the response to a very simple question. Why isn't Noah the first Jew? In other words, where does Noah go wrong? He must be an incredible human being to be able to do what he did. When you think about it, he is ultimately the first survivor. He undergoes a Holocaust the likes of which we can only imagine. When you think about it, in certain ways, far worse than the Holocaust that we were witness to or that our parents' generation was witness to 50 years ago. At least I can allow myself the out of saying not where was God, but where was man 50 years ago. I certainly can't say that in the flood. I mean, that was God. No two ways about it. Noah is told that his entire world is going to be destroyed. He loses everything. And do you know what Noah comes out of the ark and does? It's unbelievable. Here is a person who witnessed destruction on a scale of which we can only imagine. He loses everybody but his immediate family. His world, his hometown, his friends, his neighbors. I mean, there's no more cable TV. It's terrible. And he comes out, and what does he do? He offers a sacrifice to God. That's unbelievable. As a matter of fact, we're going to see just how righteous Noah was. So where does Noah go wrong? Why does Noah not succeed? Who is Noah? In fact, how is it that comes along a person 10 generations later, Abraham, and does succeed? What's the difference between Abraham and Noah? Why is Abraham the first Jew and not Noah? How is it that Abraham aspires to a level that Noah doesn't? So to do this, I want to do something a little different with you. Instead of splitting you up into chavruta, both in the interest of time and because this particular story is to be found in a bunch of different verses. So rather than write a list of on the board, this verse, and then that verse, and this verse, I want to learn this together and see how we end up. Okay? Let's see where this brings us. Let's have some fun. Open up to the beginning of the portion known as Noah, Noach, and let's do a little learning together. First of all, this will give you a chance Now that you've had a few opportunities in the different classes we've had here of learning b'chavruta, again, with partners, studying on your own, let's see how this works together so that all of us can analyze how learning b'chavruta works, okay? But I'm not going to give you a class for the next 15 or so minutes. I want to learn with you. All right? Let's learn together and see what we come up with. Everybody with me on this one?
Okay.
Verse 9.
These are the generations of Noah. Noah was a just man and perfect in his generations. And Noah walked with God.
Okay, just out of curiosity, what is the word that springs to mind here in terms of how I now view Noah? Just.
Perfect.
Walked with God. Good. You know, he's like, I mean, he's up there. I want you to know, by the way, the Hebrew word for just is always a difficulty with translation. It's tzaddik. Tzaddik perhaps means righteousness. Hence the word a righteous person, right? A tzaddik. So let's assume for the moment it's not so easy to define what a tzaddik is, but Noah is a tzaddik. It's like a debate whether anyone else in the world, just out of curiosity, is Moses a tzaddik?
What does that mean?
Ooh, good. Whatever you think it means, is Moshe a tzaddik? You know what? I don't know. You know why I don't know? Because nowhere in the Torah does it call Moshe a tzaddik. Nowhere. Same thing with Abraham. The only person in the Torah who's actually called a tzaddik is Noah. Now that's unbelievable. Noah is called a tzaddik. Abraham never is. So what does that mean? So Noah is up there. Interestingly enough, yeah, go ahead. Can we assume who? Well, then we'd have to begin to try to figure out what a tzaddik is and see if Moshe's actions fit with my definition of tzaddik. With Noach, I don't even have to know what a tzaddik is. I know he's a tzaddik because the Torah tells me he's a tzaddik. So that's got
to
be a different level.
Pardon?
No, no, no. In other words, if the Torah doesn't tell me someone's a tzaddik, then I have to think, is that person a tzaddik? Is it not a person a tzaddik? Is this action righteous? Is that action not righteous? But if the Torah tells me, listen, this person is a tzaddik, and if I'm accepting my perception that this Torah is written by God, so if God tells me someone's a tzaddik, you know what? I'll take his word for it. Right? My point here, however, is that Noah is on a level unparalleled in human history. Because no one else in the Torah is ever called a tzaddik again. So there is something incredible about Noah. Eli told Noah, ish tzaddik. It could have just said, these are the stories of Noah who was a righteous man. Instead it says, these are the generations of Noah. Now Noah was a righteous man. So that's a question. I want to tell you, by the way, that the response to that question is not difficult to find. You can look in some of the commentaries. So I'll leave you an appetite whetter and see if you have the energy to go look it up. Okay? But it's a good question. Alright. Now it's very interesting. Noah walks with God. I don't even begin to know what that means. But whatever it means, it's good. Right? So this is incredible. Then it starts to tell me a little bit, now you're going to see we're jumping around, and that's why we're doing this together. It starts to tell me a little about Noah, and then it gives me a little background about when Noah lived. And this is fascinating. Look at verse 11. Someone else, who wants to read? Another volunteer, Lisa. Right? Verse 11. Hebrew or English, I don't care which. Yeah, go ahead.
The earth also was corrupt before God.
Okay. The earth was corrupt, yeah.
And the earth was filled with violence.
And this is very interesting, by the way. The word for violence in Hebrew is chamas. I don't know if that is meant to raise the issue that it raises for us, but biblically the word for violence is chamas. The world was violent. Something was wrong. The land was filled with violence. It doesn't just say, you know, there were a group of hooligans in downtown Miami and they were violent. It says the world was violent. That's an incredible condemnation of all of mankind. Which brings me back, interestingly enough, to my original perception of Noah. Does this elevate my perception of Noah or reduce it? Think for a minute. Noah, I know, is righteous. Detail number one. Detail number two, I know that Noah lives in a time when no one else is righteous. Right? I mean, the whole world is corrupted, violent, whatever. Does this elevate Noah's stature in my eyes or reduce it? What do you think?
It can do both.
It can do both. Well, pick one.
It elevates, like, it elevates, but at the same time, like, if the entire world is bad and there was one good person, there's nothing really good to compare it to. You know, if there was a time of sin, of course it elevates it, because you think, oh my God, with all these bad people, it chose to be good.
Okay, now that's very interesting. In other words, if he could be righteous in a generation like that, I mean, it's one thing to be righteous in yeshiva, in Lubavitch. It's one thing not to speak slander at the table at Israelite. But if you can be righteous in Bucknell, if you can be righteous in, I don't know, you know, the South Bronx, well, then you're righteous. That's one way of looking at it. Anybody want to look at it the other way? There is a flip side. It's no big deal to be righteous in the South Bronx. To be righteous when you live next door to the Lubavitcher Rebbe, that's not so easy. If you live next door to the Lubavitcher Rebbe and people say, there goes a righteous person, oh, that they would even notice you. You know, it's interesting. In Jewish history, we have all sorts of figures that we lose out on because they are lost in the shadows of the brilliant luminaries who they find themselves close to. I'll give you an example. Rav Avraham ben Arambam. Avraham, the son of the Rambam, of Maimonides, who we're going to discuss soon, was an incredible scholar. He was brilliant. He was a tremendous rabbi. He never gained the stature of other commentators of his day because he was the son of the Rambam. He's even called Rav Avraham ben Arambam, the son of the Rambam. Not easy to be the son of the Rambam. Methinks that if he had been in a different period or in a different country, he would have been one of the greats of Jewish history. I'll give you another example. The sons of the Vilna Gaon, who were brilliant. We don't even know anything about them. But I once came across something that some of them wrote. Unbelievable Torah. But they were the sons of the Vilna Gaon. So in fact, there are rare exceptions to this. I'll give you one example of an exception. The Chatam Sofer, who was the Rav in Plesburg in the early 1800s, was probably one of the, if not the greatest Torah scholars of his day. He was called the Chatam Sofer, Rabbi Moshe Sofer of Pressburg. He had a son. He was called by the Chatam Sofer because that was the name of the volumes that he wrote in Halakha and Talmud. He had a son called the Ketav Sofer. The Ketav Sofer wrote a tremendous volume of works, and that was their name, and that's why he's called the Ketav Sofer, right? And he even outshone his father. He became one of the incredible Torah leaders. They say that he was even more charismatic than his father. His father wasn't as charismatic. To be able to be a Ketav Sofer, when you're the son of a Chatam Sofer, that's unbelievable. So that's my dilemma here. What does it mean that Noah is righteous? Is Noah righteous because he lived in his day? You know? Or is Noah righteous because even in his day he was able to be righteous? Two different perspectives. Everybody gets that, right? Now let me take you a stage further and do something we haven't done till now. I want to read you a Rashi. I want to share with you a Rashi. Rashi brings a comment on this verse. Again, just to remind you, Rashi is one of the most important commentators that we have. He was very interested in the context of the verses that you would be able to glean from what the story is, the lessons of the story, how it works, how it fits together as a puzzle. And he has an interesting comment. He actually quotes a midrash. Now I can say quotes a midrash and everybody knows what I mean. He quotes a midrash, right? Rabbinic legend. And listen to what he says. Right on this verse. Because if you look at this verse, it says, Noach ish tzaddik tamim haya, he was perfect, or whatever tamim means, bidorotav, in his generation. So Rashi says, that's a very interesting word. And that's a word that doesn't have to be there. Right? If we were learning this properly, we would look through the verse, we would say, what does this verse say? And one of the questions someone would probably ask is, what's bidorotav? What's that doing there? It should just say, he's righteous. What do I care if it's in his generation? Now with the background that we just discussed, so now you understand why that word is there. But Rashi is going to point out, that word doesn't help me. Because what does that mean? So look at what Rashi says. Of course we have to find the Rashi. Okay, listen to this. Bidorotav. Yesh mi rabotenu dorshim oto l'shvach. There are those who interpret this word, Ledorotav, that Noah was righteous in his generation, as a praise of Noah. Kol Shekein, it's a statement of all the more so. She'ilu haya bedor tzaddikim, because if he was in a generation of righteous people, haya tzaddik yoter, he would have been even more of a righteous person. In other words, look at Noah, who was righteous in his generation. If he would have lived in my generation, he would have been incredible. Okay. V'yesh shedorshim oto l'gnai. And there are those who interpret this in a negative fashion. Lefidaro haya tzaddik, in his generation he was righteous. Ve'ilu haya bidoro shel Avraham. But if he would have lived in the generation of Abraham, lo haya nachshav l'klum. He would not have been thought of as anything. He would have been nothing. That's what Rashi says. Now I'm judging from your face, maybe you have the same difficulty I have. This is a pretty severe statement Rashi makes. And I have a number of questions on this Rashi. I want to remind you again what Rashi says. Okay? Some of our rabbis interpret this praiseworthy. If Noah was a righteous person in his generation, then if he would have lived in another generation where there were righteous people, he would have been even more righteous. And then Rashi says, and there are those who interpret this in a negative fashion, that Noah was righteous in his generation, but if he would have lived in the generation of Abraham, then he wouldn't have been thought of as anything. What do you think about that, Rashi? We read it, now let's learn it. You'll see, everything you learn, there are patterns to learning. So what do I mean? New? New?
What are you asking right now?
Let's talk about this Rashi.
Isn't it a bit extreme?
Well, that's interesting. Let's go one at a time here. First of all, you're saying that's very extreme. Rashi doesn't say that if he would have lived in the generation of Abraham, he wouldn't have been as righteous. He says he would have been nothing. That's a very powerful statement. If Noah would have lived in the generation of Abraham, he would have been nothing. If Noah, who was the only person saved in the flood, if Noah, who brought two of every animal in the world, into an ark. I mean, they didn't give you a manual for how to get a giraffe through the door. He did it. Noah was told, you know how long it took Noah to build the ark? Anybody know? This is wild.
7 years.
And this is written in the verses. I'm not taking the time, but you can see this. 120 years. Which, by the way, 120 years in the Bible means what? Anybody know?
A lifetime.
It took him a lifetime. It was a life's project. Picture this scene. You're looking to buy a house, and you contact a real estate agent, and he takes you to a neighborhood to see a house, and you notice there's some old guy banging next door, and you get a little nervous because, you know, construction, you know, you don't want to buy a house next to a construction site. So you start asking other neighbors, oh, that's old Noah, he's been building that thing now for 50 years, says it's going to take him another 70. What's that stench? Oh yeah, he just brought in some hippopotamuses. What is that? Picture that you're Noah and you're leading in a brontosaurus for all I know. Well, what does your neighbor say? I mean, he must have been the laughing stock of the neighborhood, right? Hey, Noah! Got some lions today, huh? Pretty cool! And what was he doing? What kind of faith did it take Noah to be able to do that? Rashi says if he would have been in the generation of Abraham, he would have been nothing. Nothing.
Isn't that what Rashi's saying? Or I thought he was just presenting two positions.
The language that Rashi chooses is Ilu haya b'dorosh al Avraham, if he would have been in the generation of Abraham, lo haya nechshav leklum, he would have been thought of as nothing. Listen, I want you to know something. I think Rabbi Aaron is a good teacher. I would go so far as to say he's a great teacher. I think Rabbi Cardoza is also a great teacher. I do. I think if Rabbi Akiva came to visit us here at Israelite, I think Rabbi Cardoza would have a tough time giving a lecture after Rabbi Akiva. And is that a fair, right? I mean, but I wouldn't say if Rabbi Akiva was here, then Rabbi Cardoza would be nothing. I wouldn't say that. I'd say Rabbi Cardoza is a great teacher, but if Rabbi Cardoza lived 500 years ago, for all I know, he would have been a simple guy. Maybe every person, 1500 years ago, 2000 years ago, in the time of the Talmud, maybe everybody was on the level of Rabbi Cardoza. That was like the standard level. And then there were great rabbis. For all I know. That's right, but that doesn't mean I would call him nothing. It's a very severe statement. But okay. Give you another question. Yeah.
Then was Abraham's generation so great? I thought he was the only good one.
That's another question. What does that mean, the generation of Abraham? Like, if I was Rashi, I would have said the generation of Rabbi Akiva. I mean, when you look at the Mishnah and the Talmud, you've got like Torah scholars growing on trees. I mean, it's unbelievable. But Abraham? Who else was around in Abraham's time? Abraham has to send his servant all the way back towards Iraq and Mesopotamia just to find a bride for his son. And in the end, he finds a bride, Rivka, whose father is considered one of the arch villains in Jewish history. But since she's righteous, he grabs her because who else is around? So in the generation of... And I'll go you one further since you mentioned that. The equation doesn't work. Now Rashi was very particular about his words. He was very careful about how he said things, when he said things. And you can learn a lot by how Rashi says things. Rashi doesn't say if Noah was righteous in his generation, then he would have been even more righteous in the generation of Abraham. He says if Noah would have lived in another generation of righteous people, he would have been even more righteous. But on the flip side of the equation, he says that if Noah would have been in Abraham's generation, he wouldn't have been righteous. It doesn't work. Do you hear what I'm saying? In other words, if you're going to compare him to Abraham, then compare him to Abraham both when you're praising him and when you're putting him down. Only one half of the equation compares him to Abraham. So I want to tell you what I think. And we'll have to see what to do with this. It seems to me that the opinion that Rashi is quoting, which looks at Noah negatively, specifically looks at him negatively in view of Abraham. Does that make sense? It's not a question of generally viewing him as negative vis-a-vis other righteous people, but rather that Noah was Noah only as Noah alone. The minute I compare Noah to Abraham, then I realize that Noah wasn't Abraham. So that Rashi wants you to compare Noah to Abraham. Does that make sense? Yeah? Okay. I want to understand why.
Okay,
why am I comparing Noah to Abraham? Yeah. Now that's a very interesting point. That's not, however, my question of why I'm comparing Noah to Abraham. That's already an analysis of how I compare them. So we'll get to that. That's a very good point. I would, by the way, add one comment to that. Right? I don't know if anybody heard, but what Lisa said is that God chose Noah, but Noah chose Abraham. It's not entirely accurate. In other words, in the Bible, it's clear to me that Abraham chooses God. To a certain degree. You know what? That's not even fair. It's really Jewish tradition. Ultimately, God comes to Abraham and says, Lech lecha, go. And Abraham listens. Great. Well, God comes to Noah and says, Noah, build an ark. And Noah listens. Great. And I want you to know, if you start to read the parsha here, you begin to get a sense that there's a whole lot of Noah bashing going on. I'll give you another example. Just to give you an example. Look at chapter 7, verse 7. Oh, this is great. Is there significance to this verse? Okay. Everybody ready here? Okay, now let me ask you a question. Right, Noah goes into the ark because of the flood. Okay. Is that a comment on Noah's character? I mean, or what do you think that verse is?
Yeah. It's like, oh, it's raining, better get inside the ark. You know, it's like he's taking care of himself, this man. Right, in the ark.
Okay, that's very interesting. Okay, in other words, what could it have said? You're really already answering an unasked question. They bothered you linguistically about this verse. Pardon? Well, nobody else was commanded to get into the ark. It's fair to assume that everybody else thought he was cuckoo for cocoa bus. But also, if the whole point of destroying the world is because there were evil people in the world, then you wouldn't think that God wanted those evil people to get into the ark. The whole point of the ark was to save the one family that was righteous. So that I could understand. No, listen, I want you to know something. If we were all running into the dining room because of the storm, right? So I would imagine, you know, Rabbi Aaron was here, that we would all, you know, tell Rabbi Aaron to go in first because, you know, he's the dean, whatever, you know, so I don't know. That could be. All right. I think there's one part of the sentence that's interesting. No, you think I'm wrong? No, maybe I don't know.
Wait, but what would he do?
So okay.
The family told Noah to go.
Every once in a while, I find myself playing the door game. You ever play this game? You know, like you go on a date. So now the guy has this dilemma, right? Because if he says, oh no, after you, dear, right? Well, then he's being polite. But he also might be considered to be a chauvinist. Why do I have to walk through the door first? Well, okay, I'll walk through the door first. Pig! You know, I mean, it's like, you have this dilemma, right? Sometimes I get this with a student. Like, I could care less who walks through the door first. You know, I'm too busy thinking about where I'm coming from, where I'm going, but okay. And it's a habit with me to let other people walk through the door first because my mother's English and that's the way I was brought up, whatever it is. And sometimes, like, you play this game. Like, I realize there's a certain stage in my existence on this earth that, you know, you say someone let the door first, right? They say, no, after you. Say, no, after you, right? Then the two of you go in together and you get stuck and you go back, right? It's like a comedy of errors. So somebody says, go over there. Fine, okay, you know, like my world isn't shattered and neither is yours, right? So I could picture that scene as they're all standing in the rain. Oh, no, you go for it. No, really, we don't want you to get wet long and meanwhile everybody's getting soaked. So let's put that aside. There's another part of the sentence that boggles my mind. Well, it doesn't boggle my mind. It's something worth taking note of. Mipnei mehamabul, because of the flood. What does that mean? They went into the ark because of the flood. They went into the ark. Why did they go into the ark? Look back at verse 1 in chapter 7. Vayomer Hashem leNoah, and God says to Noah, Bo ata v'kol beitcha el hateva. Go into the ark, you, your family, the whole geshäft. Why? Because I have seen you as a righteous person before me in this generation. With the same question. So why is Noah going into the ark?
Not because of the flood.
Well, what it should say is that Noah goes to the ark. God tells you to go to the ark, you go in the ark. I want you to know. If God told me right now, I mean, how I would know whether God was telling me this, interesting question. But if God said to me, listen, I want you right now to jump up on the table, okay? Get yourself into a runner stance and take off. See if you can hit 30 miles an hour before you hit that wall. So I would think it was a strange thing for God to ask of me. But if that's what God wanted me to do, I would do it. If I knew that was what God, I mean, if I believed God was telling me to do that, it would cause me some wonderment, right? Any more than if God tells me, I want you to get up tomorrow morning, take leather, strap it around your arm, and say all these heebie-jeebie verses. So when I'm 13 years old, I say, okay, if that's what God wants me to do, I'll do it. I don't really understand it. I'd like to try and understand it. Maybe there's a portal there into another dimension where I can save world Jewry the day before the Holocaust. But, you know, without knowing that, so I'm going to do it. So God says, no, get in the ark. Now this guy's been building an ark for 120 years. So don't think like, you know, it's like God says, listen, I'm going to bring a flood. Build an ark. Build a flood. Okay, get in the ark. It didn't work like that. It's like he's been doing this every day for 120 years. You know, he gets that pitch up on the roof just perfect, you know. He's smoothing off those walls there, you know. Gets that big power tool. Yeah, building my ark. You know, he's like, you know, you ever see there was this show, Home Improvement, right? And they had this thing that the guys would all do that. Arr, right? So that's, I can picture Noah and his boys, right? You know, yeah, see my ark? Yep, planed wood there, uh-huh. Used a 4x9 screw. Arr, right? So now God says, get in. What do you mean, get in? I once met a person who was a multi-millionaire. Like, so multi that I wouldn't know the difference if he lost half his fortune. And he collected cars. Now, he didn't collect cars like my son collected cars. He collected cars. He mounted cars. He had a garage. And he insisted on taking me downstairs to show me his garage. Right? And I didn't understand what he was showing me, right? Until he started talking about them, lovingly. And he had a Bentley, which is a nice car, you know. Basically would cover the budget of Israelite for quite a while. And he's talking about these cars. And he's showing that they're incredible, whatever. And I'm thinking to myself, I can't believe that I'm here having a discussion with someone that there's so much we can do in this world and this person collects cars. But okay. So then at a certain point, you know, I innocently, you know, I'm looking at the car, he says, so what do you think, right? So I innocently think that he wants me to get into the car, sit in the car, and, you know, get a feel for what it's like. So I forget which car it was. I think it was actually a Rolls Royce. I open up the door of this car, right? And I'm about to get in. He goes, no! I said, oh, okay. Right? He goes, no, don't sit in there. These are works of art. Right? And I'm thinking like, this guy owns cars, but you can't get in the car. So I'm wondering if like Noah had this like, you know, you want me to actually get in it? It's so clean. I'm supposed to take all the animals in? I mean, they're going to make such a mess. But okay, God tells you to do it, you do it. So it may have been an act of faith for Noah to get in the ark. Bill Cosby has a routine. You ever hear Bill Cosby's routine on Noah? Oh, it's gewaldic. I want you to know Bill Cosby, Baruch Cosby. You've heard of him, right? Right? So Baruch Cosby, he's tremendous. He's much tremendous. In a different life, he was probably a great Rosh Hashiva. He's tremendous. You will never find a curse word on any of his tapes. I have incredible respect for the man. In fact, when he does a routine about cursing, right, he says, foul, filth, foul, foul, filth. I think that's wonderful, right? Anyway, he has a whole bunch of different routines on the Bible. One of them is on Noah. And, you know, Noah is complaining to God. And he said, you know, God, 100 years I've been doing this. You didn't tell me, and all the neighbors think I'm crazy. I'm trying to get the hippopotamus up into the ark, and you didn't tell me. And then there's an elephant, and I'm trying to, and the elephant's pregnant, and whoo! And all of a sudden, God says, Noah. Right? And Noah, you know, Noah's going on, and Noah, Noah's in, and the rain starts to fall. He says, how long can you tread water? Right? Noah goes in the ark. I mean, what is this verse? Mipnei mehamabu. Because Noah went in because of the water, because of the flood. In other words, the flood water came, and that's when Noah went in. And we have the same dilemma here. And you could read this either way. You could say that Noah should have gotten into the flood, and the clearest... I mean, look, it could not have been pleasant to be in that ark. Right? The size of the ark was probably about the size of this building. There's two of every animal in the world, and 7 of all the kosher animals. I'm not quite sure if they had an irrigation channel to get rid of all the waste material of these animals, or if there was some miracle that they didn't poo for 40 days, I don't know, whatever it was. But whatever it was, it couldn't have been pleasant. And to go lock yourself up, they didn't have, you know, air conditioning in those days. So it's a beautiful day. And God says to Noah, get in the ark, take your whole family. So Noah's thinking, like, I'm going to go home, I'm going to tell my wife, listen, we got to get in the ark. And she says, oh God, with the ark again. Yeah, okay, right, have a nice day. So maybe, you know, Noah's like, you know, it's difficult. So finally, when it starts to rain, and he realizes it's flood rain, like it's not stopping, so then they get in the ark. So maybe he was just, you know, he didn't quite have that level of faith. Or maybe it's the opposite. Maybe he didn't want to believe that God was really going to destroy the world. And he believed ultimately that there could be a rapprochement, that there could be repentance, that the world could be... But look what Rashi says. Rashi here is quite specific. He doesn't even leave... room for the debate. What does Rashi say here? He says, "Af Noach miktanei emunahaya." Even Noah was one of those, you know, little faithful, ye of little faith. Mamin ve'no mamin. He believed, and he also didn't believe. Sheyavo amabul that the flood will come. Velo nichnas lateva ad shedachkuhu b'mayim, hamayim, and he doesn't go in until the water forces him in. Miktanei emunah. Noah was one of little faith. Guy who just built an ark for 100 years, 120 years. How could he be one of little faith? He met God. How could you have little faith if you met? He schmoozed with God. So what's going on here? So I want to share with you one more Rashi, which is a seemingly insignificant comment that will ultimately unlock the whole story and allow us to do some thinking. I want you to know something. Sometimes you find a comment, a detail, which is so remote, so obscure, so ridiculous, that if you're reading it from the perspective that we're reading it from, as divine, has to cause you to wonder what it's doing there, why it's important. I'll give you an example, just so you understand the framework. If you study the Medrash, right around one of the Midrashim that I quoted in our class, it's actually to be found on Rosh Hashanah, the tractate in the Talmud, on Daf Yud, on the 10th page. There's an interesting debate. Rabbi Yeshua and Rabbi Lezer, if I'm not mistaken. One of them says that the world was created in Nisan, in the Jewish month of Nisan, and the world ultimately will be redeemed in the month of Nisan. And one of them says that the world was created in the Jewish month of Tishrei, and that the world will ultimately be redeemed in the month of Tishrei. Nisan is, by the way, the first month when the Jews got out of Egypt, the month of Passover. Tishrei is the first month in the creation of the world when we celebrate Rosh Hashanah. Now you read this Talmudic discussion, and you gotta sit there scratching your head. First of all, what do you mean the world was created in Nisan, the world was created in Tishrei? I mean, we celebrate Rosh Hashanah in Tishrei. But let's assume that's not a question, because it could be we just rule that the world is created in Tishrei, and that's why we celebrate Rosh Hashanah there. But the bigger question for me is this debate about when the world will be redeemed. I mean, if I know that the world is going to be redeemed, that the Messiah is going to come in Tishrei, then in the month of Cheshvan, which is the month after Tishrei, I'm going to stop praying for Mashiach, because I know that, you know, I got another 11 months to wait. What is this debate? I mean, you always get a sense that the rabbis are sitting around one Saturday afternoon, and it's really hot, and they are so bored. Hey, when do you think the world's going to be redeemed? I don't know, what do you think? I mean, what is this discussion? What's this debate? And furthermore, who cares when the world will be redeemed? If I'm the month before Nisan, let the world be redeemed in Nisan. And if I'm the month before Tishrei, let the world be redeemed in Tishrei. It's a very strange debate. Unless you take into account what I mentioned to you earlier, which is that as important as the debate is what they're really arguing about. What does this represent? Nisan is the month when we were redeemed from Egypt. When the Jewish people, according to tradition, had sunk to such a low, they were so immersed in the culture of Egypt that if they'd been left there any longer, according to the Book of Splendor, the Zohar, Kabbalah, they would never have gotten out. And when you think about the redemption from Egypt, God does everything. He brings 10 plagues, He splits the seas, He brings them out. Everything is God. What do the Jewish people do? Very little. What is Tishrei? Tishrei is the month of repentance. Tishrei is the month when I attempt to redeem myself. So the rabbis aren't debating when the world will be redeemed. The rabbis are debating how the world will be redeemed. Will redemption come because we've sunk to such a level that God, in God's infinite kindness, says, if I let it sink anymore, you'll never be able to get out of the quagmire. In other words, God will ultimately do it all. Or will the redemption come because we, on our own, attempt to bring the world closer to redemption? And it's interesting, we celebrate Rosh Hashanah in Tishrei, in the month when man was created, when man had to do, when God tells man, eat or don't eat, and everything is up to me as an individual. So that's an example. When I'm reading a Talmudic discussion like that, and I see a debate about when the world is redeemed, it's got to bother me, because it's ridiculous. Because if I understand the framework of what we're talking about here, then the fact that the rabbis would take time to discuss a nitpicking detail like that is absurd. Same here. I want to understand what is going on in a particular detail, and I'll share with you that detail. Let me just share with you one Rashi. Look at verse 16 at the bottom of page 6. God says that you should make the ark. What are you supposed to make for the ark? A tzohar. Now, what's a tzohar? This is again page 6. It's chapter 6, verse 16. So what is it you're supposed to make? A window. A window shalt thou make to the ark. Now that's the English translation. The word tzohar in Hebrew is a very difficult word. It doesn't appear that often. So we want to figure out what that word means. So what am I going to do to figure out what that word means? Well, I'll go look in different places in the Torah where the word appears, but you'll find almost nothing. So eventually I'm going to say, all right, let me see if Rashi sheds some light on this. And indeed, Rashi quotes a midrashic debate. And this midrashic debate proceeds as follows. Tzohar. What's a tzohar that you're supposed to make for the ark? Yesh omrim chalon. Some said a window. V'yesh omrim evan tova ha-me'ira lahem. And some said a precious stone which would give them light, like a chandelier. Some kind of a magical stone that, you know, they had around then, I don't know. Maybe it caught sunlight and reflected it in. A chandelier. So, what's going on here? Yeah, who cares? Well, this is a debate. Now, obviously this has to be important. It's important not only because Rashi mentions it, but because the Bible takes the time to tell me that God himself, you know, you'll notice what happened when the ark docked and it finally landed. They must have had a hell of a shock, right? So maybe they put shock absorbers. Be a good idea. It doesn't say God said put shock absorbers. I imagine cleaning up the dung of all those animals for a year, and by the way, they were in the ark for a year. 40 days it rained. But when the rain was finished and they were all the way up on the water, they didn't just get out of the ark. It took a certain amount of time for the water to go down. So they were in the ark for a year according to the Bible, right? It doesn't say anywhere that God said unto Noah, thou shalt bring thee with toilet paper. Well, they had to have toilet paper, right? They had to do something. It doesn't say bring food for yourselves. But they had to bring food. Right? So why does it take the time to tell Noah to have a window? And furthermore, since I don't really know what a tzohar is, what is this debate? A window or a chandelier? Who cares? And where does that come from? And what does it mean? So now let's just review where we're at. We've got this guy Noah who's righteous. But something doesn't work out because he's not the first Jew and things go downhill again after Noah. We don't know anything about Noah's children other than they were with him in the ark. And they have a story and some of them are positive and some of them are negative. But they certainly don't seem to continue the path. Certainly I don't have a third generation from Noah as I do from Abraham. Other than listed in order to know who begot who. They were big into begotting in those days, right? So why doesn't it work with Noah? What is this comparison between Noah and Abraham? What is this ambiguity as to whether or not Noah was righteous or wasn't righteous? And what's this window? So now that we have a question, a picture, and we obviously have to do something to figure out this question, what would that something be? What would you naturally want to do now? I want to figure out who Noah was. And I want to see, how are Noah and Abraham different? And I want to remind you of an underlying principle which is crucial. It must be that these stories are not meant for me to just know that stories happen. It must be that these stories are meant as a message. That I have to walk away with something. What am I supposed to learn from this? Not just from Noah and not just from Abraham, but even from the comparison between Noah and Abraham. Now I want you to know that Abraham lived 10 generations after Noah. The Mishnah tells us, and by the way, this is it's an oral tradition which is based on the written, because if you look in the 5th chapter of Genesis, and if you look again in the end of the portion of the week known as Noah, you will find that it lists who begat who. Right? And in fact, it will tell me, and I once did this with a class here at Israelite, and if anybody's curious about this, I'll be glad to show you how to do it. It'll tell me that Adam, when he was, let's say, I don't remember anymore, but let's say 130 years old, right? That he had a son called Shait. And then Shait, when he was like 190 years old, he had his son. And so on and so forth. And I can figure out who was around in the world when Adam died at 930. Once I can figure out that Adam met people 6 generations after him because he was 930. So I can in fact figure out that Noah, okay, was still around when Abraham was born. Based on the text, it's quite clearly there. In fact, it's interesting, and I've never decided what to do with this, but not only was Abraham born when Noah was still alive, but Abraham was 58 years old when Noah died. That's what we know. Interestingly, the name Noach is the gematria, it's the numerical equivalent of the number 58. So I'm not quite sure what to do with that, to be honest. You can ask Ray Marcus. But I will tell you that it's fair to assume that Noah and Abraham may well have met. The world was not such a big place. And there weren't that many tremendous personalities. And Noah was the father, if you think about it, of all humankind. So whether Noah actually met Abraham, Abraham probably went to hear Noah lecture. There's even a tradition in the oral tradition that there was a yeshiva called the Yeshiva of Shem and Aver, of the sons of Noah. At least Shem was the son of Noah. And that Abraham went to study there. There's even, by the way, this is even more fascinating, if you go to Tzfat, there's an old cave that they found. There was a tradition, why did Tzfat become a holy city? Why was Tzfat a city associated with the mystics and mysticism? It was like a magnet. I mean, the mystics just were drawn to Tzfat after a period of time when there was no one in Tzfat for almost 600 years. They all came back, the Ari, the Beit Yosef, the author of the Code of Jewish Law, there are Shlomo Alkovitz, all these great students. So there was a tradition that that was the place that Abraham had studied in the Yeshiva of Shem and Aver. They found, not long ago, about 30 years ago, a cave that they excavated, where they found all sorts of artifacts from that period of time, about 4,000 years ago, and there is an opinion archaeologically that this was the yeshiva of Shemin Eber. I remember when I found this out and I went to see this cave and it was like, you know. So again, I don't know what to do with it. But it's fair to assume that if Noach was around and he went on a lecture tour, that Abraham met him. So to say if Noah would have lived at the time of Abraham is very strange. Because he did. Abraham was alive before Noah died. They weren't that far apart as we think they are. It's interesting that the Bible purposely gives me two central figures, Noah and Abraham. And even though there are 10 generations in between, those are the two figures that follow each other. It's almost as though the Torah is screaming out for me to compare them. Now, how do you ever compare two individuals? This is a problem. I mean, how could we compare, let's say, I don't know, you and me? How could we compare? We're such different people. So you might sometimes make the mistake of assuming that we can compare us based on our actions. If the two of us are sitting at a table, and someone begins to say something negative about a fellow human being, and one of us gets up and leaves the table, and the other one sits there and eats it up, so then you compare the two of us and say one of us is on a higher level and the other one isn't, maybe. But of course that's ridiculous. Because where are we coming from? And how long did the one of us who was able to get up have to think about this and to prepare for this? And maybe the other one isn't even aware of the issue, so how could you ever compare two people? In fact, that's one of the biggest problems we have today. That there's a whole segment of society that compares people based on actions, calling some religious and some irreligious. It's absurd. It's ridiculous. So how do I compare Noah and Abraham? The only thing that we can do is we can wonder if perhaps there were certain situations that both of these individuals found themselves in, and perhaps if we look at a situation which was similar to both of them, we can analyze the way they reacted and see if they reacted differently. Was there a situation that Abraham found himself in that Noah had already been in? What do you think? At least a microcosm of the situation of Noah. And everybody misses this, even though it's right there in front of us. What was Noah's most difficult test? The flood. What about Abraham? Did Abraham ever undergo a flood of sorts? Pardon? Well, that's a different story. That's him attempting to do what we might interpret to be the destructive act. But there's a different story. Yeah. Oh. So God promises at the end of the story of Noah that the world will never be destroyed again. But in the time of Abraham, there is a microcosm of the world that is destroyed, and that is the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah, Sodom and Gomorrah. In essence, that is Abraham's Holocaust event. And it's interesting to note that there are a lot of comparisons between the story of Noah and the story of Abraham. Just as an example, when God destroys Sodom, it says, Hinani mamtir, I'm going to rain down fire and brimstone. Almost as though God is choosing the word that's reminiscent of the previous rain that destroyed the world. Fascinating. So now, this becomes interesting. Noah is presented with an event that is very similar to the story of Abraham, and Abraham is presented with an event that is very similar to the story that already took place in the time of Noah. So let's take a look at how they react. Because there is one fundamental difference. So now open up your Tanakh, your Chumash. Okay? You remember once we mentioned that that Abraham was sitting at the entrance to the tent, and he sees three people. He thinks they're people. They're really angels. He runs to them. We had a whole ethical, you remember this? A whole ethical discussion about this. And the angels come. These angels were sent on a mission, according to the Bible. And they had actually three missions. One of them had the mission of destroying the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah. Now, I don't want to get into, for the moment, what an angel is, how an angel works, what a mission is. But suffice it to say that God somehow makes Abraham aware of the fact that he is going to destroy Sodom, but that Abraham shouldn't worry because his nephew Lot, who's there, will be saved. Okay? That's important. Now let's see. Look at verse 20. Vayomer Hashem. You see this? Verse 20? God says, Za'akat Sdom v'Amora ki rabah. The destruction of Sdom and Amora is great. By the way, this is the exact language that's used in the, hold the page here with a finger and go back to chapter 5, if I'm not mistaken. And you'll see, interestingly enough, that in chapter 6, verse 5, it says as an introduction to the flood, Vayar Hashem, and God saw ki rabah ra'ata adam ba'aretz, that the evil of man was great. Do you see that? Right? Which is exactly the same phrase as God chooses here. Ki rabah. The same evil. It's happening again in the city of Sodom and Amor. By the way, phraseology, terminology, vocabulary is very important in the Bible, because when God chooses to use a word in two different places, He's ultimately, God is ultimately, the Bible is ultimately sharing some sort of a connection. Right? For example, if I read a verse in the Psalms, right? Tamim tiyeh, or in the book of Deuteronomy, better, I think it is, Tamim tiyeh, Mashem Elokecha, you shall be tamim before God, I automatically will think of the story of Noah, where it says that Noah was tamim. And there's a connection, and I have to find it. So, this is happening again. And God says, I want to see what's going on here. That's a difficult question. Just out of curiosity, look at verse 21. Read the verse and remind me what, and tell me what it reminds you of that we've discussed. God says, right, I'm going to go down and see. What is the obvious question in this verse? Pardon? Yeah, what is God saying? I'm going to go see if Sodom and Gomorrah are really evil. God knows. What does that remind you of? Cain and Abel, Adam. God comes to Cain and says, where's your brother? God comes to Adam and says, where are you? Same theme. What we said there is true here as well. God is saying to Adam, where are you? Can we do anything about this? He's almost offering mankind an opportunity. But they don't take it. And it's interesting that this is borne out by the verse, because God says, I'm going to go see. But then He doesn't go see. His decision is made. It's almost as though the Torah is telling me that this is the opportunity that man had and missed. Vayifnu misham anashim. So these men, these angels, they go towards Sodom. So Avraham odenu omed lifnei Hashem. And Abraham is standing before God. What does that mean, that Abraham is standing before God? What, like he found where God was in the mountains and... Pardon? Which is what? Prayer. I mean, the act of tefillah. What is the Hebrew word for prayer is tefillah. You ever hear that word, tefillah? Do you know what that word means? There are a lot of different opinions. Soloveitchik says it's the reflexive of judgment. Right? I'm judging myself. There's a verse in the Bible that speaks of the naming of one of the 12 tribes, Naphtali. Naphtali was one of the 12 sons of Jacob. And when he's named by Rachel, by Rachel, she says, Naftulei Elokim Niftalti, I have struggled the struggles of God. Lihit paleo is to struggle with myself, to struggle with God. So ultimately, God, Abraham is standing before God. That doesn't necessarily mean he's praying. Now you're going to see he's praying, whatever that means. Somehow, this conversation, this announcement, this realization that God is going to determine to destroy Sodom and Amorah is made to Abraham. So what does Abraham do? Very, very difficult word in the next verse. Read verse 23. Tell me which word makes absolutely no sense. Which word? What does verse 23 say? Abraham drew near, right? Vayigash Abraham vayomar, and he said, whatever he said. What does that mean, vayigash? He went over to God. What do you mean, went over to God? He was already standing before God. Torah makes a point of saying he was standing before God. I agree with that. But what does that mean?
I don't
know. So I want to tell you something. When I have a difficulty, I'm giving you tools here again. I'm going to give you a tool now that you're not ready to use. But file it away. because it takes me forever to teach this to yeshiva guys. If I want to really understand the power of this word, what I have to do is I have to go to something called a concordancia. Now I don't have to do this because there's a famous place this appears. But let's say you didn't know where else this word appeared. I want to see where else does the word vayigash, he drew near, appear. So I go and look up, it's a kind of a dictionary, it's called a concordance, concordancia in Hebrew. And this concordance lists all the words in the Bible and where they appear. If I want to look up where else the word or, light, appears in the Bible, I can look up at the concordance and find out that it appears in certain places. And then I can learn how to relate. And if I have a word and I don't know what the word means, so it doesn't do me any good to look it up in a dictionary because that's someone else's interpretation of what it means. First, I want to learn what it means. So I take that word and I look it up in concordance and then I go look up all the places where it appears. And then I get a sense of what this word could mean. Now sometimes that's almost impossible. Like the word Vayomer. And God said. Well, that appears in thousands of places in the Bible. If I want to understand how it's different from the word Vayedaber, which is translated in English as God spoke, right? So how do I understand what the difference is? So if I was reading Shakespeare, there might not be any difference. It's just random, you know. I just used the word, you know, sometimes when you're writing a speech or you're writing a resume, right, you know, or an article or a letter, you don't want to use the same word twice in a paragraph, right? You just said that, come up with it. So that's why we use the thesaurus. Just to make it easy to listen to. But God doesn't work that way. God has a word, and that word is exactly the word that's necessary to convey a message. And there is no other word that conveys that message. So it's important to know why God sometimes says Vayomer and sometimes says Vayedaber. The only way to really come up with a theory about this is to see every place in the Torah where Vayomer appears, and God said, and every place in the Torah where Vayedaber appears, and God spoke, and try to come up with a theory as to why all these cases are Vayedabers and all these cases are Vayomers, and then 6 years later you can come up with an answer. So it's not always easy. But sometimes it's easy. For example, the word Teva. The word Teva means an ark. There's only two other places, really. One, really, where I find the word Teva. And that's by Moses. The ark of Noah. The Teva that Noah gets into in the flood. Same word that Moshe is put into on the Nile River. Which means that there's a connection. Noah gets into an ark that's given to him by God ultimately, but that he has to build himself. And it is on the water and is the vehicle for the redemption of mankind, because he will recreate life. And Moshe gets into an ark that is ultimately built by his mother, whatever, that will float on the water of the Nile, that is the vehicle for the redemption of the Jewish people. There's a relationship there. And if I want to understand what a teva isn't just an ark, it's a vehicle for redemption. And then when I get to the ark of the covenant, which is also called a teva, all of a sudden I have a whole different perception of what that ark is supposed to be. It's not just a box, it's a vehicle, etc., etc. And that's why the Jews carried it into battle, and that's why the Jews crossed the Jordan River with it first, etc., 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 etc. So this is important. So I want to know, okay, this word, vayigash, what does this mean? So I find that there's one other instance where the word, there are a few, but one famous instance where the word Vayigash appears. And that is the instance of Judah, Yehuda. After Joseph is sold into slavery, and he ends up in Egypt, and he becomes the viceroy of Egypt, and he's long since forgotten about his brothers, at a certain point, Yehuda will find that he has to stand up and be counted. Joseph sees his brothers again, because God in the Bible has a way of making sure that the story gets finished. There's a famine in the land of Canaan, and the brothers are forced to go down to the empire of the day, to the land of Egypt. And they have to beg for food. And Joseph, through various, what's the word, workings, has succeeded in being the dispenser of food to the entire known civilization. The plan of God is unfolding. And he finds the brothers before him and he puts them through some difficult tests, and that's a very difficult question, why and how and what. And at a certain point, Joseph says, I want to see your brother Benjamin. The brothers go back and they meet Jacob, and Jacob doesn't want to send Benjamin, but finally there's no food, so Benjamin goes down with the brothers. And then Joseph orchestrates that when they leave, these brothers, that the goblet of Pharaoh will be found in the knapsack, as it were, of Benjamin. And so Joseph brings them back and says, I'm taking Benjamin into slavery. And if Benjamin goes into slavery, Jacob will die of a broken heart, because Benjamin is the only other son of his beloved wife Rachel. And Judah has promised that he won't let that happen. And so the verse comes and says, Vayigash elav Yehuda, and Judah draws near to Joseph. Now he doesn't know that this is Joseph. He thinks this is the second in command of Egypt. And he essentially says, I'm going to put my life on the line. Take me instead of Benjamin. It's an incredible act. Because when you stop to think about it, Judah is doing exactly the opposite of what the brothers had done 20 years earlier. The brothers were jealous of Joseph, and they put themselves before Joseph. And they said, Joseph is threatening our relationship with our father. So they get rid of him. Now Judah is saying, I'm putting my brother before me. That's repentance in a nutshell. I'm attempting to undo what I've done. And at this point, when Joseph realizes what Judah is doing, he breaks down into tears. And he gets everybody out of the room. And in one of the most powerful lines in the entire Bible, he looks at his brothers and he says, Ani Yosef, I am Joseph, out of Ichai. Does my father yet live? Powerful line. The word Vayigash means that Judah realizes that at a certain point you have to do what has to be done. There's a magnificent Mishnah in Ethics of the Fathers. B'makom she'ein ish, where there is no man, hishtadel liyot ish. You must try to be that person. Sometimes there's no one else to stand up and be counted. You have to try to fill that void. Sometimes there's a need. In every type of situation you can imagine. There's such a thing as a wartime decoration of rank. What's called in Hebrew, dargot sadeh. Normally, to get a new rank, you go through a whole procedure, etc. But if you're in battle, and the commander above you dies, God forbid, is killed, or is wounded, you take that person's rank automatically. You become that commander. In fact, when I was doing sergeant's course, the end of the sergeant's course, you had to learn how to be an officer, just in the event that your officer would die. And when I was doing officer's course, you had to learn how to be a company commander. And in company's commander's course, you have to learn how to be a battalion commander. Because if the battalion commander is wounded, who's going to become the battalion commander? There has to be one, the company commander. That's a very difficult thing. To stand up and say, I'm taking control. In the movie Operation Thunderbolt, when Yoni Netanyahu, the leader of the mission to rescue the Jews, the hostages from Entebbe, when he's gunned down from a tower by Ugandan soldiers, and he's lying bleeding to death on the field, they immediately radio Shuki, Mufaz, that Yoni's been hit. There's a moment's hesitation. And from scenes that I've witnessed in my life, I imagine this is probably how it was. There's a silence on the radio network for a moment. But it's the briefest of moments. Tachanot Zemel, Kanstein, all stations, this is the second in command, Ani Lokech Pikud, I'm taking command. And from that moment, that person is no longer called Stein, number two, he's called Kodkod, he's called the commander. Now look what Avraham does. Because this is unbelievable. Vayigash Avraham. And Abraham says, will you destroy the righteous with the wicked? What do you mean you're going to destroy the whole city of Sodom? Everyone in Sodom is evil? You want to tell me there's no righteous person in Sodom? Now let me ask you a question. Who is Abraham talking to here? God, right? Hello? I mean, it's the all-knowing, all-majestic, unlimited, all-powerful one, right? Like, I would expect God to just answer Abraham, duh! But that's not what God does. Look at what God does. He doesn't say a word. And Abraham says, well, maybe there's 50 righteous people in the city. You're going to destroy 50 righteous people? So what should God say now? God should say, listen, Abela, trust me. There are no 50 righteous people, because if there are 50 righteous people, like, that's not what he says. Look what he says. Abraham gives this whole argument. Chalila lecha, verse 25, top of page 18. Far be it from you to do this type of thing, to destroy the righteous with the wicked. You can't do it. It's wrong. So what does God say? Vayomer Hashem, verse 26. Im emtza b'stom chamishim tzaddikim. If I will find 50 righteous in the city of stone, then I will forgive, I will carry, as it were, the entire city because of them. Do you agree with me that that is an absolutely ridiculous statement? If I will find 50 righteous, you know? What is he, call the angels? Gabriel! Raphael, come on! Okay, look, get out the directory, let's check for righteous people. I mean, this is God! And then Abraham. Talk about chutzpah. Abraham figures on a roll. Oh, you'll save the city for 50. What about 40? What, 40 righteous people? You wouldn't save the city for 40 righteous people? So God says, okay, if there are 40 righteous people, I'll save the city. So Abraham says, well, would you go for 30? I remember when I was a kid, there was this show called Get Smart. You ever see the show? You must remember the show, right? Get Smart. So what was the whole thing? Maxwell Smart. You had to laugh at a secret agent called Maxwell. I mean, what kind of parents do you have to call a guy Maxwell? My dad's middle name is Maxwell, but that's besides the point. Okay, so Maxwell Smart, so he'd get into this situation, right? And he'd be alone in the room, surrounded by 19 agents with guns, and he just had a pencil, right? And he'd say, at this very moment, there are 400 agents outside the building surrounding us. Give it up! And the agents would look at him, and they'd have this moment of hesitancy, and nah, right, you know, and they'd like aim their guns. And then would come a famous line. Would you believe there are 100 agents, but they have double ammunition? And again, these guys are laughing. Would you believe, and you know, he'd get to the, would you believe that there are 9 Girl Scouts with cookies, but they're very violent, right? And he'd just go down there. That's what Abraham is doing here. Well, would you go for 20? Well, how about 10? What is this, like Machane Yehuda? Are we in the marketplace? We're selling cities here? What is this discussion? And then finally he gets to 10, and God says at 10, you know, Abraham says in verse 32, don't be mad, if I just speak once more, maybe there'll be 10. And he says, I won't destroy it for the 10. And then God goes, when he's finished talking to Abraham, and Abraham goes also, Ve'avram shavlim komo, Abraham goes back. So why did they stop at 10? So that's a whole separate discussion. 10 is a community. There's a fundamental difference between 10 people and 9. What the mystical significance of the number 10 is, the concept of a minion, the idea that within community lies our strength as a people and as human beings, but okay. But what is this whole discussion here? What's going on here? And then, interestingly enough, so they go down, there's a whole story with Lot, we'll skip that, go to the next page, verse 24. Finally, God gets ready to do the deal. So in verse 24, Vahashem him tir al Sodom ve'al Amorah. So God rains down on the city of Sodom and Amorah this sulfur. And verse 25, Vayafoch et ha'arim ha'el. And he turns over the cities, destroys the cities. It doesn't work. And you don't see Abraham saying, wait, did you look? Because he knows. I mean, he's talking to God. I mean, he must know whether there are 10 or whether there are 20, whatever it might be. And then Abraham does a very strange thing for a righteous person. What would you do during the killings in Rwanda? And you find out that the whole country of Rwanda is going up in smoke. So I would say, okay, we just heard terrible news. Tens of thousands of people are dying. We should learn Torah together. We should do something. We should go to the wall and say Psalms. Maybe we should run down to Rwanda and try to save people. I don't know. Depends on the level. Not so simple. You know what the last thing that you would expect, I hope, to hear from me? Imagine if the news of Rwanda broke last night and I came in the next morning and I said, listen, hey guys, did you hear about Rwanda? There's like 15,000 people dying. Listen, let's cancel class and go watch it on TV. Come! Because CNN is showing the killings. That'd be pretty weird. But look what Avram does. Verse 26. Vayashkeim Avram baboker, and Avram arises in the morning. El makom asher amad sham epnei Hashem, to the place that he stood before God. He goes back. Vayashkef al pnei Sodom v'Amora. And he looks out on the cities of Sodom and Amora. Vayar, and he sees. In other words, he goes up to see the fireworks. This is a tzaddik. He wants to see the show. It's a little bit of a strange picture. So let me share with you an unbelievable idea. And this idea is contained within the Torah Tumimah. The Torah Tumimah is a commentary that was written by Rabbi Baruch Epstein. He actually died in the ghetto in Pinsk in 1940. He was the son of the Aruch HaShulchan, tremendous Torah scholar. And he did two great things. First of all, he collected all of the Talmudic sayings, the major ones, on the Bible. Now, suppose I'm reading a verse, and I want to know what the Talmud says about this verse. So what I would have to do is I would have to look all over the Talmud to go find it. But now I have something called the Torah Tumimah, the pure Torah. And I can look it up, and it'll quote for me the Talmudic sayings from all over the Talmud on this verse. Tremendously valuable. And then the second thing he did was he then gave commentary to it. And he discusses it in a magnificent commentary. And this is valuable in two directions. When I'm studying Talmud and I come across a verse in the Bible, I'll often go to the Torah Tumimah to look and see what he says on the Talmudic discussion. Conversely, if I want to see what the Talmud says on a verse, I can look it up in the Torah Tumimah. By the way, the Torah Tumimah, at least the first half, which is the collection of Talmudic sayings, has been translated into English. So he says a magnificent thing. What's the difference between Noah and Abraham? Very often, if you want to understand a large picture, you have to look for an obscure, innocuous, seemingly ridiculous detail and build from there. That's what he does. Why was Noah told to build a window? And what's the difference between a window and a chandelier? Says the Torah Tumimah, a magnificent thought. A chandelier lights inwards. The light that I have from a chandelier comes from inside the ark. But a window, in addition to allowing light in, allows me to look out. Says the Torah Tumimah, there are two perceptions to what Noah did. And it's ambiguous. Either Noah was incredibly righteous, or Noah wasn't so righteous. On what rests my ability to determine whether Noah was righteous? Think about it. What is it that will conclude for me, will determine for me whether Noah was righteous or not? What was in here? What Noah thought? Because Noah gets in the ark. I don't know why Noah gets in the ark. I don't know if Noah gets in the ark because he finally believes the rain is coming, or if Noah gets in the ark reluctantly because he doesn't want to leave everyone else behind. I don't know if Noah is a righteous person. I know that Noah has the potential to be a righteous person because he's called righteous. The Torah makes a point of calling Noah righteous to tell me what potential he has. But with Abraham, I know Abraham's righteous. You know how I know Abraham's righteous? Not by what he thinks, by what he does. Judaism does not place as much value on thought as it does on action. You see, there's a fundamental difference between what Noah does and what Abraham does. Noah is told by God the world is going to be destroyed. Build an ark. And that's what Noah does. But what about everybody else in the world? What does Noah do for them? How could you be building an ark for 120 years and not end up bringing anybody else with you? Abraham is told by God, I'm going to destroy Sodom, and Abraham begins to argue. He struggles with God. If you can sit by and know that 500,000 people are dying in Rwanda, if you can sit here and know that there are 6 Israeli soldiers that are missing in action, that there are Jews in the Damascus ghetto that are suffering, and you don't do anything about it, then something's wrong. That's not what we're here for. Even if you think it's futile, even if you think God knows what God's doing, and it's fate and it's destiny, it doesn't matter. It doesn't excuse you from acting. And so God says to Noah, what'd you do? Where were you? How could you get in the ark alone? Because as wonderful and as incredible a human being as Noah was, as righteous a person as he was, ultimately what determines Noah's value is his actions. Nobody comes with him. He doesn't succeed in influencing anyone. He doesn't find a way to bring anyone with him. Who knows what Noah should have done? Maybe Noah should have said to God, I'm not getting in unless you let me take others with me. Hard to know. And so Abraham struggles with it. Why does Abraham go up on the mountain to look? Because if you're an Abraham, and the cities of Sodom and Amorah, and remember what Sodom and Amorah were. I mean, these were the dens of iniquity. These were Auschwitz and Birkenau in their days. But if Auschwitz and Birkenau are being destroyed, and human beings are dying, and it does not move you, then something's wrong. Something's wrong. There was a whole discussion. What to do about the burial of Eichmann, Adolf Eichmann. Adolf Eichmann was captured. He was put on trial in 1960. And he was sentenced to death. To the best of my knowledge, it's the only death sentence in the history of the state. There were big debates. Halachically, there were big debates as well. Non-Jew, murderer, destroyer. They decided in the end to cremate him and to scatter his ashes over the Mediterranean so as not to give neo-Nazis a shrine. During the time that the plane was flying over the Mediterranean, at the moment that it dropped the ashes, the Israeli radio stations broadcast the event. And there was a moment of silence for the 6 million. Now you experienced a moment of silence in this country, and so you can understand the power of it. This was a moment of silence just 15 years after the Holocaust. It's very strange. There should have been a party. Not Jews. Even an Adolf Eichmann, whose ashes are being cast into the sea, has to cause me to feel something. So God comes to Noah and says, build a window. Because your problem is that you need to look out. See those people suffering. Understand that I'm destroying a world, because if you can sit in your ark and not see them, something's wrong. Abraham goes up on the mountain as if to say, I struggled with God and I lost, but I can't sit in my tent when Sodom is being destroyed. That's what makes me an Abraham. That is ultimately the difference between Noach and Avraham. You see, Avraham struggles with God. Avraham teaches an ethic that lends itself not to activity in the mind, but activity of the hand. Avraham teaches it's not just what we think, it's not just what we desire, it's not just what we want, it's what we do. That's the message of Avraham. And you see it in Avraham's children. Because ultimately, Avraham's message to his children is how and what we do. And this is very much a part of Judaism, and we discussed this. It's not enough to want to be good. You have to be good. And Judaism demands of me to be good. And at the end of the day, it's not just about thinking good, it's about doing good. You can study the laws of tzedakah, of charity, from here to eternity. If you don't give tzedakah, you've done nothing. The purpose of studying Torah is how that Torah goes out into the world. That's the idea. And that's exactly what's going on with Noah. And that's why Rashi particularly compares Noah to Abraham. Because it is in Abraham that we can see where Noah didn't reach, despite the fact that Noah was righteous. You can be righteous. It doesn't necessarily mean that you've achieved the goal of human ethics. That's the challenge of Abraham. That's why Abraham is the first Jew. And that's why from Avraham I begin to learn a system of Jewish ethic, which is ultimately designed to make me a better person and the world a better place.
This presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990, or in Jerusalem at country code 972-2-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.